We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the Esports Biz Show. I'm your host, Justin Jacobson. This week we'll be discussing content creator talent representation. Just as a disclaimer, nothing here is intended as legal advice, as all the information is for educational purposes only. This week's guest is Alex. Alex is a senior talent agent at Dolcedo Management, as well as a licensed attorney. He works with content creators and other gaming personalities and influencers. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin. I'm super excited.
Amazing. So to start, tell us a little about your past gaming experience. What was the first game you played?
Yeah, so I got into gaming, I think I was around like 7 or 8 at the time, maybe even 6. But my parents got me a PS2. That was my first console. Never played the PS1. And my first game was Jak and Daxter and Frogger. And I think it was Madden 2001. And that was the best way for me to kind of hang out with my dad. My stepdad was to play video games. It was one of my favorite ways to bond with them. And then anytime I had friends over, that was our favorite thing to do, was go outside, play some football, baseball, basketball, whatever it is, and then come inside, relax with some nice food for my parents and play some video games.
Nice. So Madden 2001, that was the Marshall Faulk one, right?
I think so. I think Marshall Faulk was 2003, maybe.
Oh, so that was
maybe?
Eddie George.
Yeah. Okay. Like Eddie George, okay.
Okay, I was close, right? It's like the Miracle Turf and then the Eddie George one that, you know, continue the Madden curse.
Exactly.
So how'd you kind of first get involved in the creator and gaming business?
Yeah, so it's kind of a long-winded answer. I'll try and condense it as much as possible. So growing up, I always wanted to be a sports agent. You know, you watch the Jerry Maguire movie, Show Me the Money, and that's what everybody wanted to do. Did you ever see that movie, by the way?
Yeah, and Our List, did you ever see that on HBO?
Yeah. Yes. So, yes. Exactly. So you see these, you know, films and shows, and it gets people kind of excited to be a sports agent. And about my senior year of college, I knew I always wanted to go to law school to be that sports agent. And I did an internship at the sports agency, helped kind of scout some NFL talents. And I realized very quickly, once I started hearing more and more stories in the space, not just bigger agencies coming in, swooping the smaller talents from the smaller agencies that were trying to do right by these talents, I realized it wasn't a space I wanted to go into a ton. And the more I was in sports, the more I kind of became numb to sports in general. I realized I'd rather be relaxing, watching sports on Sundays, than actually be involved with the stuff that's going on. I'm sure you probably feel the same way about a lot of stuff too. Like, you know, when you're involved in it so much, it's kind of, it's less of a hobby and just more of a job, you know?
Yes, definitely see that. You know, I've definitely dealt with some sports agents and dabble in that world. And yeah, it's a grind. It's super intense. And you know, unless you have like a serious bankroll, it's really hard to, you know, recruit, scout, train the players, get them developed and keep them on. And, you know, once a player gets really good, you know, you have a big agency coming to scoop them up, and, you know, it's really, you know, hard to compete when they're like, oh, well, we represent Eli and Peyton and Drew Brees and, you know, all these other $100 million men. And you know, it's definitely an uphill battle as the newcomer trying to develop your own, you know, book of business.
Exactly. So I ended up getting accepted into Villanova Law over here in the Northeast, and it was my second year of law school. I believe the COVID year was when everything started happening. And another creator of mine, he wanted to, you know, go to law school as well. And he wasn't a creator at the time, but I had a mutual fraternity brother that went from Tampa to Oklahoma. And it was at the time their fraternity president, his name was Hunter. And we had like a 2.5 hour call while he was in Vegas one time and just talking about law school, if it's the right path for him, or going for his dream, which is to be a content creator. At the time, there was no TikTok. It was just Twitch and Instagram and YouTube. It was like the main forms of social media for these creators. So he didn't go to law school. He scored super on his LSATs, and he could have had his pick pretty much of law schools, but he has a supply chain management degree at Oklahoma, could have worked at all these different companies, but he forewent all that and decided to be a content creator. Well, he started off averaging like 5 viewers on Twitch. He was playing Vigor was the game. And not a ton of people watch it, but he slowly grew and grew to like 20 viewers. I remember I called him when we hit 20 average viewers, 20 CCC. I was like, we made it. Like, we're going to go big. Like, this is what's going to happen. Like, now we're going to blow up to like 50 viewers and it's all over. And that obviously didn't happen. But so once everything got shut down, he ended up moving down to PA from Oklahoma, drove all the way up, took a chance with me and my family. So he lived with us for a year. He worked at my dad's restaurant with me for a little bit so we could, you know, save money up and then invest into his stream and stuff like that. And eventually he started growing super big on Twitch, and then TikTok came about and we just started posting on there, seeing kind of what stuck. And he grew super quickly with that. Went up to like 1 million followers on TikTok, and then doing a good job with him, he recommended me other creators. So because of that, like, I was able to work with a ton of creators, and I started applying to jobs after law school. I thought I was going to go work in a law firm and do this on the side. But I was like, if I'm going to do it, I need to put my all into this. And luckily, my parents were nice enough to let me live at home while I did this to kind of build my book of business, found Dulcetto Management online, applied, didn't hear from anything, applied to a bunch of different other firms. And like a month later, they got back to me and then hired me with my talents, and the rest was history.
Amazing. So it's one of those things where you were kind of going down this other path, and, you know, COVID kind of disrupted that a bit. And so are you happy that you kind of went the content creator route instead of being, you know, an attorney in a different, you know, path?
Yeah, 100%. I did a clerkship for a few different firms, and I just was never super happy. It was fine. Like, I wouldn't say I was miserable, but I was staring at the clock every day around 2 or 3 o'clock and just praying the day would go faster, just hoping for it to end. And I was like, I never want to be the person that lives for the weekends, that on Sunday at like 4 or 5 o'clock, they're like, oh God, like I have to start
the
work.
Sunday scaries, yep. Right?
Mm-hmm. I did. And since I've started, I've never had any Sunday scaries, which is the coolest feeling ever. Like, I'll usually fire my laptop 7, 8 o'clock, get ready for the week, start preparing stuff, start doing my scheduled send emails, you know, have a tea, wind down at night. And it's like preparing for the week instead of being like, oh, like the week has to start.
Right. That's an amazing feeling. So tell us a little about your role as, you know, a senior talent manager, you know, talent agent, and tell us a little bit about the agency.
Yeah, 100%. So I'm right now a senior talent agent and a team manager. So essentially what I do is I have my own talents, but then under me, I have a group of 4 agents as well. And that was like essentially the next step for me. I started off as a senior agent, and then this was the next evolution, because I think one of the biggest flaws of my job is I can't help everybody. So what's the next best thing? It's to train agents to kind of work like me so they can keep helping creators. So while I don't have like my thumb, you know, directly on the pulse of all creators, I have it with the agents. So I know they're doing a good job for their creators and their talents and making sure everything's going smoothly. But the agency itself, it's based out of Montreal and Toronto. There's a modeling division, there's an influencer division, there's a sports entertainment division. Some of the notable athletes we have are Sarah Nurse, Dustin Poirier. We also have Juana, who is one of the actors on Euphoria as well. So we have a bunch of different people kind of all over the space. Kevin Cooney, Theo Vaughn, different influencers and creators that are kind of fun that everybody can kind of see. But it's more so one of my biggest things that I love about Dulcetto is there's not a ton of micromanaging. They really trust the agents to do what they're supposed to do and to pick the talents that they work really well with. We're not volume shooters. Every agent's only allowed 10 to 15 talents per agent. So it's not like you can just go and, you know, get all these different brand deals for all these different people at all times. It's like, no, you're trying to pick what's right with your talent. You're trying to find long-term partnerships. You're developing that relationship. We're not like some of those bigger agencies that have 100 talents, and it's very just, you know, deal-based. It's more, you know, personal-based. I talk to a lot of my talents probably once a week, if not biweekly. There's some I talk to every other day. So it's very relationships-heavy on our side of the company.
Amazing. So what are some of the services that you provide some of the talent?
Yeah, so we actually have our own in-house social media consultant, which is awesome. We don't really, and while the agents also get trained by her, we don't every agency says, right, 360 management. That's a big buzzword in the space, right? You see that all the time. We do everything. In reality, they don't. But we really try and show them that we're able, like, to grow their socials. We've done it with a lot of talents. So I think what's really interesting about the social media growth is a lot of our talents actually have their, like, finger on the pulse really well on what they're supposed to be doing. For example, one of my talents, Haylight and Shady, they're both super analytical, where they can look at a video and they know the exact reason every time why it's not doing well, how to improve it for the next one. So it's, we give them these services, but a lot of times there's just so many people that are so on top of it that we work with that they don't even need it a lot of times. It's more so being a friend for them, being a manager, finding them brand deals, bouncing ideas off of us. There's been times when our talents have been too busy and we've literally written out scripts for them for brand deals. And then something that's unique about our agencies that not a ton of agencies have is we have our own account managers for these brand deals so that the agents can continuously go out and find brand deals for talents, and we're not just relying on inbox management all the time. So what that means is, so my account manager is Herman, for example. He's awesome. We just brought him on a little while ago, but I'll sign off on a deal. I'll loop Herman in with the client, and then I'll loop him in with the talent. And here, talent, them already know each other. We have group chats, but, and he makes sure everything is done from A to Z. Deliverables are met. Everything is on time. The analytics, the wrap-up report, anything they missed, he goes and fix so that they're not chasing down the talent. And I'm not focused on these campaigns because they can build up, especially with like a long-term partnership where you have to do X amount of deliverables every month for a year. It's better for the agent to be focusing on new deals while the account manager manages that relationship with the client in terms of getting the deal actually done as well. So that's one of the unique things that we have too, is our own account manager for every agent for the talents to make sure everything gets done.
I mean, that's really, you know, I think that's kind of like half the battle. It's like negotiating a deal is one thing, but then executing and then getting paid on it. Like, just because you did a deal in deliverable, like, yeah, right, getting paid, that's like a whole nother battle, right?
Oh, yeah. The payment is, I'd say, probably one of the biggest flaws in the content creation influencer gaming space. Because obviously the how vendor services usually work in the real world is net 30. But a lot of times you have these companies, Apple's one of the best examples for it. They're a year behind on all their payments because they can be. And like, what are you going to do? Stop working with us?
Yeah, so we can sue us? Like, come on.
Yeah, exactly. So what's cool is we have our own accounting team. We have our accounts receivable team who will go out and they have all the dates set, and they'll go and like reach out to the brands like, hey, like payments due, follow up every week with them. And there's some people that take forever to pay, but it's just a constant following up. The talents don't have to worry about because they don't have time. Like, they have to create content. They don't have time if they have like six brand deals that haven't been paid to like worry about trying to hound them and get them. Like, that's our job to get that for them and to make sure that gets done. And it, again, it definitely is a big problem. We've had a few companies that owed people and then they go bankrupt, and it's always like navigating how that works. And it's something that's always new in the space, but payments are definitely a struggle, and that's what having a management team to help you hound those down is definitely important.
Amazing. So let's kind of talk about, you know, being an attorney who is also, you know, acting as a manager. Are there any certain learnings that you're able to kind of bring your talent? Do you see any kind of differences between, you know, agents and managers who maybe, you know, aren't licensed attorneys?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, you would think that when you work with another attorney, attorneys have this bad connotation that, you know, that they're, am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
I mean, yeah, you can, you know.
They're the A word. I won't say the actual thing, but that's.
They're
that's
schmucks. Usually, we can throw that one out.
Okay. Yeah. They're schmucks is what people would say about attorneys. So, but it's funny because I feel like when you deal with attorneys in this space, for a lot of the part, they're actually really smart and outgoing people that want to help as well, because they're people that came into the space because they want to help. And again, that's not everybody. But now it's people like you, and there's other people in the space that are like that. And you can tell that they have just kind of that it factor with them. Because when you deal with a lot of agents sometimes who aren't attorneys, and again, this isn't everybody, this is just, it's not a blanket statement. But sometimes they try a little bit too hard to prove that they're an agent when they see you're an attorney, and they're just like hard for no reason, or they're redlining stuff for no reason. And it's just, they're asking for certain clauses to be taken out or put in that really don't make any sense and just delay stuff to almost like one up you, or an ego thing. When a lot of times there are attorneys who are like, yeah, like we see this clause, like we'll take it out, like we'll do this. And you know, they might be more flexible. They might understand where you're coming from, or like we were talking about earlier, you might appreciate a really well-written agreement where you're like, that is you know, a nice clause where it's well written, it makes a lot of sense. Take it out, but it's well written. But yeah, I think that, but also the idea of the critical thinking that comes with it. Because with contracts, if you see enough, whether you're an attorney or not, eventually you'll start to understand what clauses to look for, what to see. But I think law school doesn't really, like, it helped me with contracts, but it doesn't teach you to be an attorney. It teaches you to think like an attorney. And that's the big thing. It teaches you to think outside the box, to critically think. Like, a lot of times there's issues you have with brand deals, and it's, how can we audible and make this work instead of just being like, okay, like, I guess we'll try somebody else. We'll try something else. It's like, no, let's get creative on this. Let's figure out how we can still work together, or some kind of middle ground or something. And I think that comes from a legal background of critically thinking, understanding it. Because, you know, in law school, there's no yes or no answer. Every answer is, well, maybe.
Maybe,
you
know, right?
Yeah. That's what they always tell you. You know, you get it.
Getting to maybe, right? That's the book you're supposed to read.
Yep, yep, exactly. So it's funny because you do all that and you're getting a set of facts and you read one of the judges' reasoning from like an old case. And you're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. I'm glad they ruled that way. But then the next case is that getting overturned. And you're like, wait, what? And then you're reading like, okay, well, that makes sense too.
Exactly.
Why they overturned it. And it's the same idea. It's just applying that critical thinking, understanding both sides, and using, I think law school teaches you, like, they always talk about taking pieces of the pie, or like kind of creating more pieces of the pie, the integrative negotiation solutions that kind of come with it. I think law school is a really good example of how that helps.
Right. I think that's a really great point of, you know, getting a little bit more creative, right? It's like, we can get creative on the structure. We can build in incentives. We can build in, you know, clawbacks and like, we can build in all of these mechanisms based on performance, right? We don't just have to be like, it costs X to do this. And that, I think, is where someone who's, you know, understands negotiation and kind of, like you said, comes from this more critical thinking of like, okay, maybe they want to only spend this, but what do we do to maybe get more, where they also don't necessarily feel like they're overpaying, right? It's like, we don't, and that's where the, you know, understanding both sides, where it's like, you understand that they want to get value for what they're doing, right? They don't want to feel ripped off, and no one wants to feel ripped off. So if you can be like, oh, well, we can do your budget, but if we kill it and hit it out of the park, we want, you know, bonus, whatever, that's probably reasonable. And it's going to be hard for them to argue, because if it happens, great. They did well and the money is made. And if it doesn't, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Justin. That's exactly kind of how I look at it too. It's, if we have these higher rates, I understand that there's more risks associated with them sometimes. And sometimes, if it's just going to be paid media, like, the rate might be the rate just because of how brand heavy it is. But there's so many things that go into brand deals. Like, is there creative control? Is it just an ad read? Like, what do they want from them? Are they using them for their editing ability? So all that stuff goes into it. So like you said, we've had deals where we'll have a higher rate and they're like, well, we really can't do that rate because we need to hit a certain KPI. I was like, well, that's fine. I'm glad you told me that. Like, I'm not here to hide the ball. I understand you have a job to do. I have a job to do. And I'm never the agent that'll just pitch the highest rate possible and make sure, like, yeah, we, like, crushed on this brand deal, because it's a relationship space and they're going to be like, well, that was an overpay. We didn't hit our KPIs. So when they tell me their KPIs, I'm like, look, just give me, like, a budget you have. I'm not going to ask for the maximum budget. I can fit creators that'll work that mold, or this creator, but we'll do the performance-based stuff. Say it's like a 4K base, but then if they hit above, if you're looking for a $10 CPM, they hit 500K to $1,000 every time after that. And if you have a hard cap, and we'll cap it like 1, 2, 3 million views with those performance bonuses. But then, you know, like, there's no risk associated with it because you're getting your KPIs no matter what, and the talent's getting paid for hitting those marks for you.
And it incentivizes everyone, right? The talent goes a little bit extra because they know that it's going to benefit them, as opposed to, okay, you're giving me, you know, $5,000 to show this new ad. Okay, it's in the YouTube video. Here it is. You know, have a nice day. Like, it's a different thing when you have this added incentive. And obviously we know that adding a little bit more money makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's funny because we always are open to that, but then there's sometimes our brands want, instead of that, they'll say like, oh, no base, but let's just do all CPM. And it's like, we have to pay them for their time, for their editing, all the stuff that goes into it, their name and likeness. So like, we have to have some sort of base. And the same thing with like YouTube videos, like, we want view guarantees in 30 days. Well, sometimes YouTube videos are slower burn. Like, we've had talent been stuck at like 50,000 views, and then 2, 3 months from now, it's at like 600,000 views. It's like, we never like making guarantees, but we always tell them, if you pay a certain rate, if you come to our rate and we don't perform, I always tell my talents, like, let's post on another social. Let's maybe do like a make good post. Like, let's mend the relationship versus like them demanding it out the gate, I think is very different versus us showing good faith and being like, look, just trust us. Like, we know if we're not going to hit the goal of the campaign or we're not even close, we'll make it up to you. Like, I have that relationship with my talents where they're like, okay, like, I can see the long-term benefit of this and they're willing to do it.
Right. And so I guess that kind of like comes to, you know, being an attorney. Tell us a little about some of these fiduciary duties that, you know, maybe come to your client that might not exist with, you know, managers and, you know, agents that aren't attorneys and maybe aren't subject to these things.
Yeah. What it's actually funny is in the entertainment space, it's whether you're an attorney or not, like, you're going to owe fiduciary duty to your talent. It's something I did a little research on myself too when I first got into it, and you always will owe, you know, that higher standard.
Because of the agent principal relationship, right?
Exactly that. So like, it's, while being an attorney, right, there's always that standard in this space. Like, you still have that standard too, right? So like, it's, you have to be on top of things, always act in the best interest of your talent. So it's not anything that being an attorney is special with, because if you're an agent, you have to do it anyway.
Right. And I think that, you know, kind of where I was leaning was like, as an attorney, you're held to kind of this higher ethical obligation, right? Like, there's still a bar, a state bar that you're admitted to. There's still the ABA ethics that, you know, most states have adopted where, you know, maybe something might not be illegal or break the law, but it might be considered unethical and you might violate your duties as an attorney that are potentially supersede and, you know, I know to me are a lot more important than anything else, right? Like, I'm not going to jeopardize my license in the work I do. And I feel like most attorneys feel that way.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I just think, regardless, when you're an attorney, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about like agents trying to prove their agents, attorneys are always just trying to make sure that they're doing the right thing a lot of times, like, for their talents and just working with good people. And a lot of agents, you know, they might go different paths or methods, and they're not like actually bringing deals to their talents or telling them about the deals they're bringing, or they're just hiding stuff from them, versus attorneys, I would hope, wouldn't do stuff like that. Like, they're always, you know, letting them know like, hey, this is here, you know, you should look out for this. And agents are just, when they're volume shooters, again, they're just looking at the bottom line a lot of the times. They're not really, they don't have that close relationship with their talent. They're just out there to make, you know, the most bang for their buck. So I think attorneys definitely have more of that ethical standard behind them, for sure.
Right. I think that's important. I think it sometimes gets overlooked that, you know, in this talent-driven world, you need to hold your representation accountable, right? Like, mm-hmm. if they're, you know, holding themselves out and they're, you know, manning your mailbox and, you know, being your point of contact. I've heard of stories of brands shooting, you know, deals to people and never being brought to their talent. The agents, you know, just passing on the deal without ever presenting to them. Like, as an attorney, you don't really have that right. Like, it's not your deal to decide. You know, yeah. You may, like, I was, you know, when I was doing this stuff, it's like, if the fee isn't going to be right, like, I'm just not going to be involved in execution negotiation of it. Like, you can do it, but it's not going to involve me and my services, right? Like,
yeah.
You're not in that position to say yay or nay, right?
No, 100%. So, I mean, I completely agree with you on all that.
So how do you, you know, help creators maybe, you know, after their active career, maybe transitioning to their after world, you know, after career, or maybe going to new entertainment verticals, like going from, you know, gaming into sports or to cooking or lifestyle? Is that something that you advise on?
Yeah, no, 100%. It's funny because I think in this space, the burnout rate is so high, whether you're a pro gamer, whether you're a content creator. Especially in gaming, more so, I think, than any other vertical. It's like, when you have to play, like, your audience is so driven a lot of times by the game you're playing. If you're a Warzone creator and you go outside Warzone, a lot of times your audience isn't going to come with you. Like, you might think they like you for you, and they do, but they also like watching that game, right? It's like, if I'm watching football and an athlete I like goes and plays baseball, I'll probably watch them a little bit play baseball, but I'm still going to be focused on football and seeing the actual sport itself versus going to watch them in another sport. It's just not that interesting for me. And it's the same kind of concept with gaming. People think, oh, if I stay in gaming, then it's the same thing. It's like, no, people will watch you for a specific game that they themselves play and they enjoy. So the burnout rate's super high. I've had a ton of talents have switched games because they can't take it anymore and they just want to play something different. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's different. but we're always trying to help build something for them after, build their brand, just kind of grow them as an individual in general, whether it's like simple things like merch drops, just ideas that kind of get outside the normal zone of, and we don't take a cut of like the merch drops or anything, but we help them out, kind of set their platforms up, and a lot of creators have success with it. But it's funny, we actually have one creator that's an agent now for us. Like I think that's a natural progression in the content creation world, is maybe becoming an agent. So my one talent's name is Bush. He was super small, did really good UGC work. We had a few brand deals, and he's working at a real estate company before, part-time as a content, or he's full-time there, part-time as content creator, but he always loved this space. And I was like, well, if you're not going to do content anymore, you should really become an agent. Like, I think you would crush it as an agent. He was so personable. He has knowledge in the space. He's seen how brand deals work. He's seen how an agent relationship works. So he came over here as an agent, and he's been crushing it ever since. So that's something where I've had other talents asking about that, because I haven't had any talents have gone through the career cycle yet, because I'm still relatively new in the space. But we have a lot of people who were talents that are now agents for our company in general. And I think that's a great step for them, because again, you can't be, you can, but it's very hard to be a content creator for 10, 20 years. You even see some of the bigger creators step away, take a break. Tfue's one of them. And just people, they'll sell their YouTube. And it's just like a lot for them, because it's so much work. And while it's really fun to be in, I think it's one of the most mentally and emotionally taxing jobs you could ever do, is be a content creator or gamer. Because you could be the nicest person in the world, and people are going to hate you. They're going to comment on your little insecurities.
And then if you're a female gamer, oh my God, it's just 10 times worse.
Yeah, if you're a female gamer, it is horrible. We have one of ours is Steffi Evans. That's who Justin represents. And she's incredible. But she always does the bits on, you know, toxic masculinity, all that stuff that goes on. And she started a nonprofit as well, on Mute. And she's been crushing it over there too. And she's just helping kind of shed the light on that, because it is really, really, really tough if you're a female in the space who is, you know, trying to break out, because it's a very male dominated space. So anytime you have, and she has a predominant female audience, which is super rare too, as a female content creator. So yeah, it's so taxing, and trying to find the life after it is something that I work really hard with my talents to gear up for. Tell them about, like, hey, you know, maybe if I find a financial advisor, it's not our job, we don't do that, but look into that. Find ways to save your money. Don't just spend your money, because this is, it's like an NFL athlete.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's some awesome accounts in the space I always recommend. Like, there's so many people that want to help, and it's such a new space that you have to have people that are knowledgeable. Like, don't just get any old accountant. Like, you have to have somebody that's knowledgeable of gaming and content creation, how the taxes work. Because I have accountants, and they're a little bit older, and they might not fully understand it. They're like family accountants. So when I tell them these things, they just have no idea what's going on. So it's like one of those things where you got to find people that you trust. And that's the most important thing, is people you trust. I think it's a space where you really need to have a feel for the people you're working with.
Definitely. So how are these creators taking advantage of most, and how do representatives like agents and attorneys and managers kind of help them?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think there's so many different ways. And it's ways they might not even realize it, especially like when they're quote unquote partnering with brands. Like, brands will especially in the gaming space, like they'll say they're partners and stuff like that, and they're not paying them anything. They're using their name and likeness. The amount of perpetuity language I see in contracts is disgusting. It's almost like every contract at this point. Stuff where they can essentially, like, even if you're done with a brand, they'll keep you up on the website, they'll keep paying to promote your post. And most creators think this is cool, because they're like, oh, like, this brand's going to keep like showcasing me. Like, that's cool to be associated with them. But if a company like Secret Labs is promoting you as their ambassador, and you're not getting paid anything, but in the contract, they can keep doing that. And then Herman Miller wants to work with you, and Herman Miller's like, well, why are you in a Secret Labs ad? Like, that's a problem now. And there's nothing you can really do, because you agreed to this contract where they can keep doing that. And now people are confused. And they're like, wait, are you with this brand? Are you not with this brand? And there's other things I've seen in contracts, like it's like if you say something, there's a non-disparagement clause where it's like if you say something negative about a brand, it'll be minus. So we try to get like a CPM, like we try to tell this brand the value of impressions. Like, no, we don't really value impressions, only conversions. Yet they had a clause in their contract that said for every 1,000 views on a negative video on us, that's $4 you owe us. So it's like, well, what can we do that but positive for the views we did in video? Well, obviously, we're taking that clause out. And they were what's funny is they took it out right away. Like, they didn't fight us. Like, yeah, that's fine. But it's the fact that it's in there and that people are just signing it. You know, again, they weren't like going to keep it in there. They weren't fighting. No, we have to have it. They're like, okay, yeah. So I think what happens is a lot of brands just try and throw stuff in there in their contracts, assuming people won't read it. And then people sign off. And I think it's where creators, they'll send, like, sometimes I see 20, 30 page contracts with a lot of nothing. But the idea of a contract being that long for a $500 deal or a $1,000 deal, the creator's like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's a little money. I don't want to read all this. I don't want to pay for an attorney for this. So I'm just going to sign it. And that's what they do a lot. They just throw a lot of legalese in there, try and confuse the creators. And so stuff like that, I just see so many people get taken advantage of with it. Payment terms, like sometimes I've seen like net 120, and that's super rare, but it's just like, you don't realize there's so many things you have to negotiate, usages, paid media, name and likeness, payment terms. Like, there's so much stuff that goes into negotiation contracts, not just one video, $1,000.
Or this money, exactly.
Exactly. There's, anytime brands like, what's your rate? And I'm like, well, it depends. Like, what are you asking
what
for?
What do you want?
Yeah, it's like, I can't just give you a rate for, like, what's rate for one TikTok? I was like, again, I need more information. I can't just say, hey, here's the rate for TikTok. Because I've done that in the past when I first started. And I'll be like, all right, yeah, the rate's $5,000. And I'll get like a contract. And it's like 1 year paid media. And I'm like, see, that's exactly why I don't say rates. It's because it's way more now because you're using his name and likeness. He has over 1 million followers for a whole year. So it's right. There's so many different ways.
Right. I think that's one of the funny things. It's like, you know, doing a deal was like a one-off stream and they have like a 6-month non-compete for like any category. And it's like, that literally makes zero sense. And I, you know, said, take that out. And like you said, yeah, no problem. And it's just little things that they're not focusing, you know, the talent themselves are focused on the number, the deliverables. Oh, they're going to be $5,000 for two posts. Great. Yeah. But again, what can they do with these posts, right? If you're doing a Red Bull ad, it's really going to be hard for G Fuel to pay you if there's Red Bull merch all over the place and if Red Bull is circulating these ads. Because like you said, they're not going to want to. There's no value if Red Bull could still use your face on cans if Monster wants to pay you.
Yeah, no, 100%. The non-compete clauses are another. I've seen so many contracts, especially in the supplement space with non-competes, where a supplement brand that does everything – they'll do like protein powder, hydration, and they'll do, you know, everything across the sun for that. And it's like, and they'll give you $500 a month. And you're like, well, I can go work with this hydration brand for $1,500 a month versus this $500 a month. And you're trying to explain how opportunity costs work for these brands because you're like, hey, if I take yours, I can't work with any of these categories. So you have to make up for that opportunity cost and pay me more. And they just don't comprehend that sometimes. And it's an issue because people sign off on these deals. And that's like the only source of income they can essentially get, especially if they're like a fitness creator, because that brand paying them X amount a month, but they own every category.
Right. It was like talking to someone, I was like, oh, well, water is different than like, you know, whatever you say, you know, protein shake, energy. It was like, no, they put it in hydration. I'm like, you know, soft drink, because soda is different than water, which is different than liquor, which is different, you know, now an alcoholic versus alcoholic. Like, as you expand the categories, as you narrow it down, it has huge implications.
Yeah, 100%.
So what advice do you have for creators that are looking for, you know, managers and representation? You know, how do you kind of vet it? What, you know, when should they go about looking for them?
Yeah, 100%. I don't think there's ever a bad time to look for management, but I will say, I think the, because it all depends on what the management is going to do. Are you starting from like scratch where you don't really have a following? If that's the case, it's going to be really hard to get a manager to work with you unless – you know, I had a rare situation where I worked with somebody I knew and we started from zero and built from there. Like, I would never say you should never have one depending on your size. But I'd say for the most part, if you're somebody that's super serious, you're full time, it's when you believe you can start monetizing your content. When you're starting to get some inbounds and you don't really know how to handle them, brands are starting to show some interest in you and you really don't know your, you know, your rate or how you should be pitching them or how you should actually do these brand deals or, you know, how to value yourself, or again, just how to look at even the simplest thing of a contract. It's just when you're starting to, I'd say, like, garner interest from brands, because a lot of times if brands aren't reaching out to you to start, it's going to be really tough to, you know, show brands who you are when you're doing outreach, because a lot of times they have like all these filters on social media where they can reach out to talents and they can see who they are. But it's weird because there is no like set number of views. There's no set number of followers because it varies for every agency, for every manager. For me, it really was just about if somebody had a really good work ethic and I saw like consistent growth. you're more likely to get management if you're growing than if you were big and your numbers are declining, for sure. Just because it's unfortunately the way the business is they look for an upwards trajectory. So anybody that is, you know, growing at a rapid rate, and the simple thing is that it factor. I like to, you know, when I have calls with these talents, can they hold a conversation? Can they talk most of the time? Like, do I have to keep kind of drawing questions out of them? Like, I want on the initial calls for them to dominate the calls. I want them to showcase their personality. But if I'm on a call with them and it's super dry and they're really not, I'm not getting anything out of them, then sometimes, like, if I have these brand calls with them or they have a brand deal, like, I don't know how they're going to react to that kind of stuff, you know? Right. So it's a lot of, like, intangibles almost is how I kind of look at it.
So from the talent side, how do you kind of, you know, maybe decide what agents or managers to work with or attorneys, like anything, questions you ask them? How do you, you know, make that decision?
Yeah. So if you're a talent and you're looking for a good agent or manager, I would do some research on talents already with the agency and talents who might have left the agency. Kind of get both sides of the story and figure out and ask the agent too. Like, if the agent's not willing to tell you, hey, these talents have left, go talk to them, or these talents are here, they could be hiding something. If anybody ever asks, and it's rare, we have a ton of turnover on our side, but if anybody ever asks to talk to any talents I don't work with anymore, I would 100%, you know, have them reach out to them, talk to them, because it's usually nothing but good things. And no agency is perfect, but it's just do your research on the agency, because they're not every management or agency is your best interest in mind. There are a lot of bad ones out there. There are a lot of volume shooters, a lot of ones that won't care about you and you'll get stuck with them. A huge, huge red flag is if you ever see, in my opinion, a management agreement that's strictly just brand deals. Like, they're not an attorney, they're not doing anything for you. They're a management that does the 360 management, and they have a monthly fee associated with it that requires zero work on their end. Because there are some agencies that would have like a $1,000 fee monthly just to work with them without actually even doing anything, like at all, not looking for contracts, just like being on their roster. And I know talents have lost and sunk a ton of money into that. And there was like no termination clause and it was a mess. So I don't know if there's many of them left, but I have heard of stories like that.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't be paying a manager a fee for him to manage you and then a percentage of your income. Like,
exactly.
That is not really the guiding post in most entertainment fields. Obviously, there's different things if they're providing you editing or graphic design or other tangible services built into that. Maybe. Again, we're not giving any legal advice here, but just, you know, as people that have worked with talent and agents for, you know, me almost 2 decades and my friend Alex here for, you know, probably a decade plus at this point, there's a lot of opportunities for people, you know, to take advantage of those who don't realize. And that's why you need to, like he said, do your research, talk to people they're working with as well as people that used to work there, you know. And obviously, if someone left, you got to take their opinion with a grain of salt sometimes, you know, because there's always three sides to a story, right? There's my side, their side, and the truth, which is somewhere in the middle of the stories, you know, give or take some facts.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for creators? Do you think that they should focus on one platform or, you know, focus on multiple? And what benefits, you know, do you see from working on multiple ones?
Yeah, 100%. I'd say as many platforms as you can. With that being said, right, I would stick to, while you can, depending on your resources, depending on time, short form versus long form. Everybody always wants to do long form content because, you know, that content's evergreen. Like, the money will continuously come in from that, versus short form is very brand deal heavy and long form is less brand deal focused. Now, with the creativity program on TikTok, there's more incentives to, and, you know, YouTube's been paying out money for shorts. Like, you do get paid on views now. Granted, it's not as high as YouTube long form. But I think short form content is the bread and butter right now with the attention span of people. With, you're seeing essentially the TV ads back in the day are now being pushed towards influencer marketing, creator marketing. It's not many people are watching ads on TV anymore. They're going towards their phone, towards their computer. So it's, how are we going to get those ads there? We'll work with content creators and influencers. That's where the younger generation is. They're all on their phones. They're on their parents' phones. I see it with my 7-year-old and 4-year-old little brother. It's the same thing. They're on ads. They're downloading Top War on my stepmom's phone and they're playing it. And I'm like, this is insane. I see the Top War ads all the time. So seeing them play is crazy. But I would say stick to multiple platforms as you can. Like, there's no reason not to post your TikToks on Shorts. No reason not to post on Reels. I'd say Reels is a really underrated platform right now. A lot of brands like Reels because TikTok, you can have 1.5 million followers. You can have 1 million followers. You can have 10,000 followers. It doesn't matter. What are your average views? You know, obviously the followers help, but nobody is watching your stuff on the followers tab. It's always almost for you 99% of the time. Versus Reels, while there's discovery, if you have 100,000 followers on Reels, that's, I think, 10 times more valuable than 100,000 followers or 100,000 followers on TikTok or on Instagram versus 100,000 followers on TikTok. The Instagram's way more valuable because your engagement rate's definitely going to be higher. And when you post, a certain amount of people from your audience is guaranteed to see that versus TikTok. Like, there really is no guarantee. You can have 10 million followers and have a video that gets 5,000 views. Where Reels, if you're continuously growing, that won't happen.
And I think that's really important that everyone out there, it's that you have to diversify, you know, having platform in different places, connecting with different fans that engage. You got to be everywhere because you never know where people are going to be. And we never know what legislation and, you know, other policy changes may happen to platforms, right? We've seen creators from, you know, Fortnite Mobile have to shift and PUBG Mobile in other countries. And, you know, maybe we'll see what happens with, you know, TikTok and if that's going to be a whole interesting dilemma that, you know, I'm sure we could talk about for a while, but so what advice do you have for anyone that's looking to try to, you know, get involved in the, you know, the content creator business as, you know, more of a professional?
Yeah. So when you say more professional, you mean like somebody wants to be an agent?
Yeah. Someone's maybe trying to be an agent or manager, someone that's looking at it from that side.
Yeah. I would say the most basic step is to start consuming content. Because when you, it sounds, you know, I hate social media in that sense of like, I have to kind of consume the content, but I get it because what happens is if I'm consuming my creators' content and looking at other creators' content, I can see what people in the space are doing. I can see where the industry's trending, industry trends, finding creators to go get. And I would say like, reach out to people on LinkedIn, find people in the space that you want to do, connect with them, interact on their stuff, engage. I'm somebody where if you reach out to me on LinkedIn right away, for the most part, like I should answer right away, whether you're interacting with me or not. Other people, they probably get a ton of DMs. So it's best to naturally engage and don't ask them for a job or anything like that. Just pick their brains. When I started, I reached out to probably like 20 or 30 people and I ended up going to like DreamHack Dallas. Stephanie Wallers was the person that, you know, started me off. She's, I think, with Knight right now, Knight Management. But she was a photographer at the time. This was 2019. And she's like, yes, go to events and network. So I just went to DreamHack. I met a bunch of people, networked, and I was like, okay, this is super cool. So just reach out to people, go to as many events as you can if you're in college, if you're in law school, and just network. But don't network with the sense of needing something from somebody because that's the worst way you can network. Network with just wanting to be, just be hungry for knowledge and kind of seeing what people say and applying that. That's like the best advice, I think, is just go to events, network, and reach out to people on LinkedIn because there's no set path. There's no degree you can take. There's no like, what was I going to say, major you can take that I think really prepares you for this. It's a very relationship heavy space. So kind of understanding how to do that and make yourself comfortable with being uncomfortable. Go to an event without knowing anybody. Just go walk up to people, talk to people, like learn how to do that because that will set you apart from somebody else.
Right. That's like a unique skill where it's like, I can just go to an event. You can just go to an event and just, you know, I'm at the bar and I'm just talking to the random person next to you. You're waiting in line for the bathroom. You're just waiting in line outside. And it's just like, that's a skill in itself, is just being able to be, you know, personable. And, you know, like you said, people like people that are like that. Right. I think that most of the people I deal with are because they just like dealing with you, right? Like in these worlds, there are people you like dealing with, people you don't like dealing with. And sometimes you avoid dealing with those people because you don't need that. There's so many opportunities out there. And I think that's something that, you know, I think you touched on earlier and we kind of bring it back to that. It's like, you know, these people think that, you know, acting like Ari Gold in the phone and negotiation is like how you actually do it. But let's be real, Ari Emanuel, who Ari Gold is based off of, is certainly not acting like that. And he's certainly not negotiating like that. You know, not, I can't testify that that's not how he is, but ultimately most of the good negotiations are not, you know, handled in that manner. And I think, again, if people don't like dealing with certain people, they're just probably going to try to avoid it. And, you know, sometimes you burn enough bridges, you know, you're on your own island.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had a brand deal I used to do with a talent on Instagram. I didn't manage him, but a brand I knew really liked him, so I worked on exclusively. And he eventually got management. And like a little Instagram DM. I wrote the contract form. It was super, super creator friendly. I was like, look, like you can have an attorney look over this, but I promise you, like, this is going to be the easiest contract ever. You'll understand every clause. It's just going to be a page and a half. Very, very simple. It's just pretty much telling you to post this video. There's no usages, no anything. And worked really well for 4 months. And then he eventually got management from another company. And I kid you not, a thing that took span over like 1-2 messages for me and him with his agent took 36 emails for the same quick, like, couple grand deal. And I haven't worked with them since because his agent was such a headache to work with. And he was an attorney, just constantly like redlining everything, changing all the stuff, wanting this. And like the brand got mad because we were delayed posting a month because of this like agent just taking a long time to respond, just being difficult for no reason, being like, nope, can't do it. And it's like, I promise you, we already worked here. This is an easy deal.
Right. I think that's a really unique point there. So what's the future of talent representation in the creator space? You know, where do you think it goes from here?
Yeah, it's growing so, so fast. I think there's so many agencies popping up kind of out of nowhere. I think it's kind of surprising because you see so many like middleman agencies and non-exclusive agencies and agencies representing agencies. And it's kind of a wild, wild west almost. I think it's going to grow really, really fast. I think more and more brands are going to put money towards it as they kind of shift away from traditional marketing and more towards this new wave marketing. But I think it's going to be a very long and tedious path because more and more people are going to see that. And they're just going to pop out of the woodworks. And anybody and everybody thinks they can be an agent or manage a talent. And it's just not how it works at all. But you're seeing it so much. And then people are just on LinkedIn posting about them managing talents and saying like, they know what they're doing, but they're just copying and pasting somebody else's posts and just lying about the stuff. Or like, well, it's such a strange world. It's like the NIL world right now with college sports. It's the Wild West. It's the same thing where nobody's truly understanding how to get a grasp on it. There's just a ton of players in the space that are representing people and figuring out as they go. That's why I like Dulcetto Management because they've been in the space since, you know, 2007. They were one of the first people to ever represent a digital influencer on Instagram. So they've been, you know, we've been around for a very long time, but all these new ones that pop up that promise all these things, I think it's going to be a long, long road for a lot of people that, you know, pick the wrong management. But I think the industry is going to grow very, very fast in gaming and content creation, especially in gaming. And we saw the kind of the org bubble pop a little bit recently and you see the layoffs and stuff, but I think that's just what people were overspending. A lot of VCs were overspending. I saw a little correction, but the future is extremely bright for it. And a lot of brands are actively in games like Fortnite, Roblox. So it's just going to continuously grow at a rapid rate.
Right. I agree with that. So what's your favorite part about working in the creator and gaming space?
Yeah, I'd say my favorite part is just making a difference in people's lives. Seeing the text from my creators, you know, how grateful they are, and being as close to them as I am. You know, a lot of my creators are my best friends. And I think that's what's really cool at the end of the day. As I'm close with all of them, I visit a lot of them. I hang out with them. I text
you're
them.
The real life calls. E, that yeah, A, you're the real yeah, life the real E. Life.
Yeah, the real life E is a great way to put it. You know, I got my Vinny Chases. So it's really fun to do good stuff with good people, and that's like one of the most satisfying things ever. Like, are my talents the biggest talents in the entire industry? No, but do I want that? It's not what I'm looking for. I think it's more satisfying to grow them to that point than to just grab somebody at that point myself, just how I am as an agent. And I don't think there's anything wrong with like getting people that are super big. I just, for how I operate as a person, I get a lot of satisfaction in growing with them and seeing them become their true potential.
Definitely. I understand that, you know, journey, watching them come from where they are and then achieve stuff. And, you know, it's pretty awesome. So what's the future for you in the space and, you know, for the management agency?
Yeah, future for me is just honestly continue doing what I'm doing. I don't, like I was saying, I don't have any Sunday scaries. I generally love what I do. I work remote. I get to travel. I get to work with really cool people every single day, people I really care about. It's weird when you come from a law background and you're not used to really enjoying your superiors. The firms I worked at, I enjoyed my superiors. They're super nice. But for the most part, a lot of places I interviewed at just wasn't a great fit, that type of management style. Versus here, it's, you know, I was at my boss's wedding. Like, I'm super close with them. I really enjoy every day the people I get to talk to and work with. So I don't see myself. I always thought I wanted to start my own agency way back when, but I just realized I wanted the freedom of not being under like a thumb from an employer the whole time is what I really didn't want. Versus here, it is almost like I have an agency, you know, I'm helping run and grow the gaming and entertainment division. We started off as the esports division when I joined, and I was like, no, like we need to shift that immediately. That's a buzzword that everybody uses in gaming. Shift it to gaming and entertainment, because it's, you know, full-scale sketch comedians, gamers, everything like that. So it's just continuously evolve in my company and continuously get agents. We're always on the lookout for people that could be great fits. And build an awesome team in-house to continuously represent content creators.
Amazing. So I like to try to end each episode with my three questions. So what's your favorite game to watch?
I would say Rocket League. Back in the day, that was a sport that kind of got me into it. I remember sitting on my couch and watching Team Vitality. And that was always super cool watching them go and watching all these careers. Like Squishy Muffins was always a fun guy to watch. K-Dop. And the announcers, like, there's always that one clip, like, this is Rocket League. Like, that clip is always one of my favorite ones ever. And it was just something that was very close to, like, sports and gaming for me. And I understood it pretty easily because I played a ton of Rocket League myself. And I loved watching Pro Fortnite, but the problem was, with all the building and stuff, it's so hard to follow sometimes at the end of the day. What about you?
I was a big NBA 2K fan, I would say. But, you know, I enjoy watching... Rocket League is fun. It's intense. Like, you know, like you said, it's very easy to follow. So what's your favorite game to play?
It's funny you mentioned NBA 2K because it's NBA 2K and Fortnite right now. I love – The Witcher is my favorite game of all time, but NBA 2K, me and my buddy, we have an association that we do online together. And whenever we have free time, we just play. You know, we sim the regular season, then we play in the playoffs, and we play each other in the finals. That's always a ton of fun. And Fortnite, me and my friends, it's just the best way for us to connect. And then sometimes I was hoping the new Battlefront would have been a little bit better, but that was one that I was looking forward to playing as well because that was one of my favorite games as a kid.
So who's your favorite video game character?
Ooh, either Geralt of Rivia, Jack from Jack and Daxter. That's actually a phenomenal question. Those are probably my top two, though. What about you?
Can't go wrong with The Witcher. You know, I'm gonna have to throw that one out there. You know, definitely in that Mario, Luigi, Nintendo vibe. So I can see that being. But my Mario Kart go-to is definitely Toad. So, you know, go for the little speedster.
Yeah. I'm a big I love that. I didn't think about that. I forgot about GameCube there completely. I mean, me and my buddies play Strikers all the time whenever we're home, and Mario Kart, and Mario Superstar Baseball. But yeah, I'm a Toad and Diddy Kong guy. You know, I always love rocking the mushrooms and the giant banana.
Nice. So this is so amazing. You know, thanks for joining us. Tell everybody where they can find you and, you know, learn about what you guys are working on.
Yeah, 100%. So you can find us on Dolcetto.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Alexander Melendez, or Twitter and IG, Hollywood Clutch.
Nice. Well, everyone, thanks again for tuning in. And make sure to follow me on Twitter, Justin JESQ. Check Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube for all our past episodes.
Thanks for